My favorite movie as a kid was like War Games. And and then when I first got a computer, of course, like the first thing I did was like, oh my God, you can call in like the Defense Department.
Now that I've got my first Windows 95 PC, I'm
like,
gonna...
Oh yeah, I'm definitely going to like somehow communicate with NORAD.
I'm gonna use my free disk trial of America Online to get onto the NSA server.
You know that we all thought that stuff.
I mean, that's basically still how it is on like on a Law & Order TV show where they're like, can you hack it, please?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And
yes.
The teenager is like, yeah. And then they're like, the teenager guesses the password or something. Yeah.
I just love if it was like for real, it would be like, yeah, sure, let me send a quick phishing email to this person at the NSA.
Yeah, exactly.
And now we wait.
Oh, here, I found this guy's email. Yeah, hold on. He's a boomer. Excellent.
As long as I put urgent, he always opens.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Who is this Mailer Damon that we so much about?
The Death Panel. If you are not a patron, consider becoming one. Support the show. Get access to the second episode that is just for patrons only that comes out on Mondays. What was this week's episode? We covered those wild memos and single executive order out of the Trump administration.
Yeah. It was the best coverage of the executive order that I heard. It was the one that we did.
The skinniest of skinny supports. But yeah, become a patron and you also get a special discount code for merch.
Mm-hmm.
So... anyways, we've got this great long-term care report that I'm excited to get into, but before
and eventually
we do that,
we're going to have to talk about Kamala Harris.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
the obligatory.
Yeah. We don't want to do it. We know you guys don't want to hear it, but
we'll make it short and sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the Death Panel, so we promise this will be a Kamala Harris conversation that will not be like all the other shows. We have other things to address on that point. So, but before all of that, you know, torture and group self-harm. let's talk about this media Cold War frenzy over the Sputnik 5 Russian vaccine program.
I was driving when I heard that it was called that, and I like nearly had to pull the car over. I was like, no, we're not doing this again.
I gotta say, this was just the laziest, like, cut and paste from, like, 1985. Just, like, oof.
So, just to background, if you are not already aware that Russia has a vaccine that is named after its Cold War space program.
A little on the nose, considering, like, last week's free episode was about vaccine nationalism and how the U.S. is like perpetuating a Cold War mentality over it. Yeah,
really,
you'll have to see it played into.
We really just appreciate the continuity of storylines from people. Thank you for providing this to us.
No, but so what's happened is that Russia has a national vaccine program, which is being run out of the Gamaleya facility, which is outside of Moscow. It's sort of their like premier biosciences research center.
Mm-hmm.
And the vaccine has been running through some sort of like very accelerated clinical trial process with possibly some very real ethical violations that have gone on in that capacity. But they have
who
announced...
hasn't done a little ethical violation?
What drug study doesn't actually involve coercion? Actually, mm-hmm. But it's just what we decide is acceptable coercion and what's unacceptable coercion.
They wouldn't have called it Project Warp Speed if they weren't planning on violating some ethics rules.
The U.S. one,
So we have Warp Speed versus Sputnik 5. Real, real good there, boys.
I mean, classically, Americans live in the fictional. We name our things after fictional things. Russians just name them after their more glorious past.
I mean, this just sounds like Toy Story 7 COVID. You know what I mean? Like...
yeah.
It's so what's happened, though, is that Russia has announced not only is this vaccine going through accelerated trials? But they've announced a national vaccination program, which is supposed to commence in October, and they have opened up bidding for people to other countries to say, we want to get on the list to purchase. So far, the only one that publicly has come forward is the Philippines, with Duterte like tweeting that he was really excited about the Russian vaccine and had full confidence in them.
Right.
Russia says that there are 20 other countries that have reached out, but so far the only one I've found that's been public about their outreach has been Philippines. So like, obviously this is a little, like, the circumstances of this is suspect. Mm-hmm. That said, like, the way that this is being framed in U.S. media is like a whole other thing from what's actually going on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't make a habit of watching MSNBC, but I'm guessing, just guessing, that like already this is being described as like the plot to take over. Like, this is, you know, they've given up election meddling this year, and they're really putting all of their eggs in like the, you know, poison Americans basket.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean, if you look at like the comment section on pretty much any article on
the
this
Hill one, was like, oh boy,
I didn't even read that, but it's the funny. Well, I mean, the comment section is about as insane as the like actual articles themselves. But the comment section is all basically like, okay, now follow me here. What if in February they started secret human trials? But like the actual, I mean, can I just say before we like get into how this actually administratively happened? Because actually, it's really interesting what they in order to like make this announcement.
I wanted to get into how The Hill was framing it, which was literally, and I quote, the so-called phase three trials.
Oh boy.
Okay.
I want to point to one thing. This isn't from like a major news site, but this is from a new resource that we found called Trial Site, which is all about, which is like, I guess, an industry blog about medical trials.
I definitely didn't spend 5 hours yesterday going through their back catalog.
Yeah. Let me just like read this. So stop me if this sounds like, let's say, an unfair characterization or a pot calling a kettle black, let's say.
Uh-huh.
So this is describing how it's being, or how parts of this vaccine, you know, whatever its actual efficacy or not, like, has been rolled out. Quote, in what to the West, capital W, West,
of course,
would seem like a strange alternate reality, a program was created to allow wealthy, powerful, and influential Russians to sign up early to essentially serve the state as human guinea pigs.
You know when you get that vibe and you're reading a blog and you're like, these people love Larry Mead.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's
I just love the highest and mightiest one could conceivably get up on their high horse about that particular detail is that like America is better because we do phase three trials before giving our vaccines to rich people first. It's like, guys,
it's not like there were, I don't know, articles in Vanity Fair as early as like March 2nd headlined Rich Americans Trying to Get the Coronavirus Vaccine Early Like It's a Pair of Limited Edition Air Jordans. I mean, <Yep.
laughs> definitely no corollary there.
Right. It's also not exactly the same as Trump fucking taking hydroxychloroquine for months.
Well, that is a little different because that's basically like Zach Bush MD level shit.
I mean, tomato, tomato.
So like basically what's actually going on, regardless of like how this is being framed, is quite interesting, though, because so like I think it's worth stating, if you don't know, like the United States and the European Union have the strictest approval guidelines and the largest requirements for cohort size for testing for like drug trials, right? So the US actually has the slowest drug approval process of any developed country. So the first thing that none of this coverage is taking into account is the fact that already inherently during non-plague times, there would be a significant difference between the length and size of the studies that are going on between a Russian biopharmaceutical study and a U.S. one, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's already a huge discrepancy in the clinical process and the length of that, right?
Right.
Then on top of it, there is a law that Russian parliament passed much like, you know, we've been talking about with challenge trials and Operation Warp Speed in the United States, which said, basically, you're allowed to do the approval process after phase two trials and operate your phase three trials as if it's a phase four trial.
Like a post-market trial.
Right, which the phase four trial is typically the one that's the long study done after it's already been FDA approved to make sure that, you know, long-term drugs don't, you know, turn your toenails blue or something. You know what I mean? Like, so it's already from the get-go, this framing of like, they're, you know, skipping the so-called stage three trial is like absolutely kind of absurd, frankly.
Yeah, in the sense that like this, the reason that you make that critique is it's not necessarily just science that's like going on. So like ultimately you're going to see a lot of scientists quoted in these articles, but they're, you can't ignore the possibility in the real sort of reality that there are geopolitics in the way that these trials are like interpreted, received, and understood, in the sense that like, yes, like there is a demand now that is international for a very quickly approved drug. And like, we can get into questions about whether or not like, you know, the sort of trade-offs between safety and speed to development. But those are, I guess the point to make is that those are questions that are international. It's not like Russia is like this outlier necessarily in the way of in like in the need for speed, I guess you would say. Is that is that fair? Is that a fair characterization when we do the comparison?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the thing too that's like important to note is that like also the US has laws that are similar to what Russia passed in parliament, which is like
right to try, you mean?
Or well, right to try is like a whole sort of like other animal, but we have like compassionate access and humanitarian use provisions that have that like most drugs the FDA requires to like complete phase three clinical trials, but under specific provisions of FDA rules and regulations, actually the circumstance of like a COVID vaccine would probably be a candidate to go to market during or in the course of like phase three trials, not necessarily after, because phase three trials can take like 2, 3, 4 years, up to 30,000 people. Phase three is safety and efficacy in large scale groups. So I think it's important to understand the sort of framing and like how this is like being warped as the idea of like, well, yeah, there is a question of is this PR hype or is this like, you know, scientific innovation or whatever? But at the same time, it's also like, it's really like kind of gross to see people like Alex Azar going out there and being like, the point is not who has it first. The point is who has
the
most
child. It was the most insulting to everyone's intelligence. It's like, come on.
Yeah. Because, like, let's be real. Let
we
me just talk
been
about
beating our chests or anything, saying that we're gonna like do the vaccine first and get all the doses first. Like, whatever.
Yeah, it's like a lot of like a lot of straw man arguments and Trojan horses in this whole situation. But I think it is interesting to talk about like what type of vaccine this is. Have you guys ever heard of the adenoviral vector vaccines?
Only in connection with this.
Oh,
but
definitely.
Yeah.
I know all about it, for sure.
Tell us, enlighten us on this. Like,
there are a few other companies that are developing vaccines with the same technology that's being used by Russia on Sputnik V. One example is the CanSino Biologics vaccine, which is out of China. That's been in like massive trials, human trials since March, right? You have the University of Oxford, which is the one I mentioned earlier, the AstraZeneca. That's been in human trials since April. And you have Johnson & Johnson, which is entering human trials in September. So, like, in a lot of ways, the Russian vaccine is not actually
doing just the same idea, basically.
It's the same idea. Right. And it's also kind of at the same timeline as all the other vaccines, two of which are being done by capital W Western countries,
Yeah.
But, oh, no, you only have the, like, CanSino Biologics, which is the Chinese one, and the Sputnik V, which arguably deserves ridicule because its name is dumb. Like, you have those framed that way, but not the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccine, right? Those are warp speed. Those are innovation.
But yeah, but it's important. I mean, the geopolitical project is not merely the development of a vaccine or the race, I guess you would say, the space race, right? But it's also the way in which the sort of clinical trial idiom is like reframed and repackaged. There's a soft power element to this as well, which is that if you don't somehow do this boundary work of like, this is, you know, this very politically inflected science that we're doing is very different from the politically inflected science that Russia is doing. I mean, the only really responsible reporting on this I saw in the Financial Times, which says basically this, which is that, yes, are there problems with this? What Russia is doing? Yes. Like, is it wrong to like make these sort of pronouncements before there's been the sort of safety and efficacy, you know, test? Yes. But it's like, you cannot draw that distinction between that and what's going on in Western countries is, it's a political choice to say that, right? It's it reflects less about the science than one would think,
especially in the context of all the allegations from the past like 2 weeks that Russia has had hackers steal Western vaccine technology. Like, the implication in a lot of these articles is like, there's usually a line that says, well, and this might sound like Cold War ideology, but compared to the Cold War, Russia has not made significant scientific gains and is actually like far less scientifically advanced than it was then compared to the United States. And Russia's been accused of stealing proprietary information from American and international drug companies. So they're basically saying that like Russia cheated off of the West and then have been ramming this through in an unethical way. That's probably not true. Have they been ramming it through in an unethical way? Kind of. Mm-hmm. Are they the only ones? Absolutely not. You know what I mean?
And it would be more responsible, I guess, because there is, look, there are ethical considerations here, and there are real questions about, in a situation where you have a pandemic and where efficacy and safety is like maybe not up to the standards that you would usually have, and but where there's this real trade-off in terms of, you know, it's very clear that, at least in the United States, we're not willing to do anything else that would make this bearable. And so we're staking everything on the vaccine. So, but there's like a real question about where you draw that line and like what the right trade-off is. But rather than that, rather than having that, we're going to have the same tired like pablum about Russia versus the United States. So it just completely distracts from the real political issues that we, I think are just like completely unwilling to deal with.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right.
I think it's particularly interesting in this like article that was a Forbes article about it, which like talked about all the normal, like, you know, the Russia scare, Red Scare crap that we've just been talking about, but then went on to note that it was particularly suspicious that Russia's announcement did not move stocks for Russian pharmaceuticals.
That's very interesting. Mm. Any sense of why that is?
They implied that it was because the vaccine technology was stolen and that like sort of people in Russia knew. But there have been like a couple mentions of it in the framework of like, no one's publicly announced that they want to buy it except for the Philippines. So it wouldn't necessarily be moving stock prices the same way, because when the, you know, when the Western drug companies say, you know, we're going to do this, then it's like a different market. I don't know.
Could it also?
They don't put out an announcement unless they want to move their margins. That's the whole point of them.
Right. Exactly.
What is trade media for anyway? But could it also have to do with just the fact that the laboratory that is producing it is like a government run facility, and that like,
frankly,
I don't know.
This is just a stupid arms race thing, and I don't think that we should like be searching for meaning. And I think it's just like a funny point of noting. I don't know. It'll be something to keep an eye on. Maybe we'll start watching Russian pharmaceutical prices from now on. Who knows? It'll be interesting to see how this drug develops in conjunction with the quote unquote capital W Western.
I also hope to see how people, like especially Trump, react to this, considering that, I don't know, one of the things that is in these news stories is that the scientists who were developing the vaccine really early on tested it on themselves. Which I love, because it's very like Resident Evil or something. So, you know, I look forward to the day when basically like Trump orders the CIA to go get the Russian vaccine or something, and then
for him,
like, yeah, for him, right, just for himself.
Should we move on to the long-term care report that came out of Department of Treasury this week?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Quietly, in 2017, the Trump administration decided that they were going to instruct the Department of Treasury to analyze the long-term care insurance market, looking for possibilities for innovation and what was the other word that they used?
Product development.
Yeah, innovation and product development.
wasn't the word access in there somewhere? I feel
yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this Treasury Department report finally dropped this week, and big surprise, but it fails to reach any meaningful conclusions or recommendations.
Well, I was sort of thinking about this because when I first saw it, I was like, huh. Treasury Department, because that's right? really who I want to tell me about long-term care.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's yeah. really the people who've been thinking. But then it occurred to me that really there are not a lot of institutions within the federal government that are really interested in or have any sort of incentive to do any kind of long-term thinking about, like, what long-term care ought to look like in, you know, the next 20 to 25 years. You've got CMS, which is really focused on sort of like maintaining the shitty long-term care system that we currently have.
Yeah.
You have Congress, which occasionally will commission like a special panel, which will be made up of, like, you know, some like deficit hawks who will say something like, you know, well, we're not killing grandma. And then you have like the
not
aging
actively.
Committees. Yeah, you have the aging committee in the Senate. That doesn't really do very much. You've got and then you've got like the Treasury Department, which of course thinks about this with the sort of lens of insurance companies mm-hmm. and the long-term care industry. And if you look at the people that were consulted on this report, because of course the people in the Treasury Department don't have enough knowledge about the long-term care market to write this themselves. And if you look mm-hmm. at like the list of like stakeholders that were consulted, there were only two, I think, patient advocate organizations at all, which yeah. you can call AARP that. I don't know
no,
at this
you
point.
Can't.
They sell
no.
magazines yeah. and others and like cruises. And like Alzheimer's Association. And then the rest was just like, it's all either actuaries like Milliman or you've got such wonderful companies as America's Health Insurance Plans, oh, Lincoln boy. National, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, New York Life Insurance Company, Transamerica Life Insurance Company. So it's sort of like, it seemed like they were going off the reverse mortgage people to like write this report.
Like, this is interesting because first of all, like, no one, like literally no one is covering this. There's like a Forbes article, I think, that I found about this mm-hmm. That is like talking about, you know, that is talking about this Treasury report and how basically very silently, like the Trump administration considered making tweaks to long-term care, which is sort of like the kind of thing that I don't know. I would expect that you would like do to try and have maybe this document out like in time to, I don't know, rally seniors or something for your reelection. Basically,
right.
I don't know,
right.
To like announce somehow that you would be able to like make little tweaks to, long-term care. Cause as we've mentioned, and as Phil was saying, like, you know, every once in a while, a panel will be convened to like talk about how absolutely like fucking depraved our long-term care system is in like in the US and to like try and come to conclusions about how to change it basically. But it's like, even in the past, whenever this does come up, mm-hmm. the like the solutions that ever get offered are like meaningless. I don't know. This is like a
yeah.
I think this is another example of the it's because it doesn't come around that often. But like, there's this very interesting like complete unwillingness to even explore things outside of like keeping this as a market, which is obviously going to be a failed market. Right.
Right.
As we've talked
yeah.
about before.
I mean, so like the funny thing about these reports is because they're written by actuaries or like they're heavily informed by actuarial science and the sort of like the science that informs how insurance companies think, you know, these people know that these markets don't work. Right. Mm-hmm. They always start with like, OK, so what's wrong here? Well, there's asymmetric information and adverse selection. Long-term care insurers basically face the fact that individuals know more about their own risks than the insurer. There are mm-hmm. Reasons why people will not buy the insurance until they need it, which creates really, really high premiums. And then there are all of these other things, like the fact that you that people are more likely to spend down their savings to qualify for Medicaid, or, you know, basically shift care costs onto other members of their family through unpaid care. So like they have this, they have to like say all of this, right? But then the conclusion that they reach is like, well, we can do things to like make this market, you know, better. And
right.
I think that at least, you know, until long-term care insurance got incorporated into like the single payer proposals for a long time, I think the left edge, or like the leading or most sort of radical edge of any of these proposals, was something like a voluntary long-term care benefit that the federal government would like sort of subsidize, which we know was like would be insolvent almost immediately.
Right.
The
right.
only way that you can do it is like a financing gimmick. So it just like,
well, if you're going to fund it through some sort of like, if you're going to do like what the Obama administration proposed, which is to essentially make it so that like it would have to be self-financing.
Yeah. Right? And that's, you know, there was also a Ted Kennedy joint.
Oh yeah, totally.
Funnily enough. But the idea is that like the whole framework of health policy, like the whole like intellectual sort of like chassis of health policy, which is like, oh yes, deficit reduction and like self-funding programs, is like fundamentally inconsistent with doing anything to like make long-term care insurance not horrible. And like just like the idea that like social insurance isn't even a part of this discussion, and the fact that like the only organization that's consistently now, I guess, like putting out these reports is like the Treasury Department. I mean, that bespeaks like the basic like institutional challenge of doing this.
Yeah, totally. And then ultimately there's a bunch of like very like wonks wet dream kind of yeah. shit in here, like including a suggestion of something that would be called Retirement Plus, which just sounds like hell, which is essentially that you would add in addition to like having contributions to like a retirement savings account, like a 401k or whatever, mm-hmm. you would basically buy into like a long-term care insurance plan through your employer, which again, this is like, it's the worst. There's no way to like make this a like profitable marketplace. It's absurd.
Also,
wasn't the other suggestion like you could have a product that was like, because like one of the stipulations that they said is like, well, people are worried that they'll buy it and then never have to use it, which is number one, that's, you're going to have to use it.
Right.
But they're like, well, what if we just said that if you don't use it, that rolls over into life insurance and it'll pay for your funeral?
Oh my God.
I mean, that's really where we are.
Or the idea of like the incidental benefits where you could access some of your benefits before you would qualify for the full thing.
Right.
Which is also
enhancing what are called short-term long-term care plans, which is like the funniest thing to me. Well, that's the thing. The biggest part of the market right now is like, you know, short-term plans that cover long-term care, which means that they expire after like at least a year, like probably usually max a year, I think, and offer really limited coverage.
People usually only need long-term care for 1 year, their whole life.
Yeah, right. Definitely. But so, right,
I'm curious, like, truly, what is that even for? Like, what possible reason could you have for the majority of the market to literally be buying a plan?
It's to
like that.
Make you feel covered, and like assure people that you have, like, you know, but then like give a backdoor to insurance companies to make sure that they don't, you know, suddenly like have to be responsible for, you know, something that like, again, ultimately it makes no sense to have as part of the private market. I wasn't trying to get us off on this like total wonk tangent though. I was trying to say that while there's all this like, you know, sort of like little tweaks here and there in this, can I just highlight my favorite thing about it, which I think really illustrates the shallowness of the like vision here and understanding of not only what is required in terms of long-term care and like, you know, caring for people with disabilities throughout their entire lives, caring for like people who are elderly and need long-term care, not only that, but sort of like betrays like a basic mischaracterization, misunderstanding, or privileged attitude, I guess, toward the fundamentals of the economy, which is they cite specifically, they go on this whole thing about how education about long-term care.
It's just financial literacy is the problem. People are just so dumb that they don't know how to buy long-term care insurance properly. If we only taught them how to manage their money better, then it would be no problem at
all. Or not even teach them, teach companies, because they say, they cite a 2019 report, quote, "Additionally, the NAIC plan includes developing an education campaign targeting employers to provide retirement plans and assist employees with saving for retirement."
I mean, so point of information like that, that's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So those are the regulators, which so but this is actually important because the regulators, their goal is to, like, the way that they see it is to, like, balance the risk pool. They see that as the goal of regulation. Not to, like, make long-term care affordable or to make long-term care widely available to people who need it. It's to balance whatever risk pool it currently exists.
Right. Which also, I mean, which elsewhere in the report, they suggest you could strengthen companies' ability to make judgments on the potential risk of the people buying long-term care insurance, which it cites even, like, I mean, this is like the fundamental absurdity. Even just looking at the figures that they cite in this study is just, you know, obviously completely damning. They reference a couple of different estimates, but, like, there are estimates up to and including, like, $500 billion a year is spent in basically unremunerated care, essentially, that, like, which is, like, accounting for, like, people essentially do, like, people, for instance, like, family members, like, partners, friends, whatever, doing care work that is necessary for someone to survive, but then not, but then, you know, obviously not being paid for it, and also then, you know, otherwise not being engaged in other, like, economic activity,
right,
or whatever. So
and also not, like, adding to their Social Security disability insurance work credits,
right,
which would allow them to, like, have some sort of healthcare protection later if they were, say, injured caring for a loved one, which happens often, by the way.
So that's like a Fortune 500 company, though, you know what I mean, in scale. Like, that's like a that's like half of an Apple company, you know.
I read a medical study the other day which was talking about the effects of disablement on unremunerated, like, care workers who are family members, right? Who are trying to do things like transfers or assists in and out of the shower without the training, who then get injured and become permanently disabled from, like, either messing up their back or their shoulder or their knee to such an extent because they're, like, not paid, not trained or anything, and just, like, put in this position where they're the only person to help their family member, right? Yeah. It's something like 5,000 people a year, which might not sound like a lot, right? But
that is a lot, though.
That is a fucking lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's a very specific circumstance that you're talking about, too.
Right. Like, someone, assisting somebody getting into the shower and then slipping yourself and becoming disabled from that. That's an extremely specific situation.
It's not
situation.
Even that specific. It is, like, literally more like the wear and tear of helping someone for five, six years, while also maybe working four jobs and, like, all this extra labor and all this extra wear and tear on your body that actually is involved in care work.
I'm just saying that in itself is a very large figure for still a quite specific field of injury or you know, to use that study's word, disablement.
Right.
Like,
doesn't it sort of feel like when you cite that figure, it sort of feels like this report, essentially the attitude of those writing this report are like, how do we capture some of that $500 billion? Because that's just money that we're leaving on the table here.
I think I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again, which is that, like, I was once doing some research on policies for caregivers, and we had proposals that were like, pay them or I don't know, give them social security credits for doing it, or, you know, really, really basic stuff. And the people in the room who were from a little firm, I'll just call it the Bland Corporation, were like, well, what if we had Uber for, you know, 80-year-olds? Like, what if we had Uber long-term care? Like, what about that?
Right.
And it's just like, okay, yeah. No, please leave the room. Never speak again. Never write another thing about long-term care. Your long-term care advice card has been revoked.
Right.
Right.
Well, and also I just want to, I mentioned this earlier, but I didn't have the statistic in front of me, but specifically when I mentioned like how, you know, a lot of people are denied simply even signing up for long-term care insurance. Mm-hmm. And that also, not only this sort of like skimpiness of how much care is like provided, even in this plan, the most generous thing they say in this document is like, well, you know, Medicare could explore having 20 hours of long-term care a week covered, which like is, if you just think about how that's split up across a week, you know, right. It's like a paltry amount of hours for a lot of people who need like a lot, who need a lot of assistance. And when you think about the figure of like the, you know, the amount of whatever money and work hours, essentially,
right.
that constitutes unpaid long-term care labor, again, by like friends or family or whoever, that stuff and the skimpiness of coverage is all in some ways reflected in like the fact that long-term care insurance itself is basically allowed to do the things that everyone says that like private insurance companies can't do, like the covering pre-existing, like the whole pre-existing conditions conversation. Like long-term mm-hmm. care, which is literally, again, separated out for some reason as though it's like in the same, I've made this point before, but in the same kind of absurdity mm-hmm. as like it is for the US and other countries to separate health insurance from like vision and dental or whatever, like mm-hmm. long-term care is separated out. And like when you actually apply for long-term care insurance, the rate of rejection is like 20 to 25% of applicants for private long-term care insurance mm-hmm. are denied on medical grounds. Mm. So they're literally right. denied because the company just like makes a decision that, oh, well, you know, you can't, we're not going to sell you a long-term care insurance policy because you will definitely be using it soon mm-hmm. or immediately.
Right.
Like
right.
this is like, that is, I mean, that in itself is just like, okay, how can you look at the system and not just, I mean, this whole document to me is just like, this right. is how, this is a massive condemnation of the way that we slowly put people to death, basically.
Yeah. Right.
But in this case, the report is like that, but then in the form of like looking like an Excel spreadsheet or something.
I mean, it just right. reminds me of like we've had this conversation a couple times, like, but pre-COVID, we were talking about those Medicare Advantage plans that were doing stuff like United putting like
good transition.
Houseless people into apartments for 1 year and then right. they have to pay for it themselves.
No, and then Medicaid United recipients. Becomes the landlord.
Right. Oh, yeah. After. And then United right. becomes yeah. the landlord. And it's like the state Medicaid program. Wasn't that Nevada or Arizona? And then there's the Humana's Bold Goal with the Healthy Happy Days for seniors, goal. Right? Mm-hmm. Where seniors have to report their happy days. And there was that other one, I can't even remember which one it was, but it was a Medicare Advantage plan that had this whole idea where it was like, there's going to be these like deluxe incentives to your Medicare Advantage where you can select one of these like 12 options in 14 specific markets
right, yeah.
for this That's specific right. tier of plan. One of which was like no more than like
10 hours 60, of long-term
it was
care
like 61 way trips to a doctor's yeah. appointment
right.
or like 12 meals every 14 days delay. It was or like, yeah. And then
one Greyhound bus ride yeah. to the Yukon territory, one way,
one ticket, that's like one guaranteed plot in like an unmarked Potter's field,
a single plum
for 6 months
floating in perfume served in a man's hat.
Right. Yeah. And one of those was like, it's something like, you know, 10 hours of long-term care a month.
Right, yeah.
Or like 300 hours a year or yeah. something. And it's just, wild. It's wild how politically, quote unquote, impossible long-term care is assumed to be. The market is predatory, extractive. People are paid nothing, right? And that is directly contributing to like both like misery, despair, and as the study would say, probably disablement of those long-term care workers who often work in multiple facilities, multiple jobs, are on their feet for hours a day. They're none of them are staffed adequately. And this is directly contributing to fucking COVID deaths, right? You know, it's something like 40% of COVID deaths countrywide right now are occurring in nursing homes. There is a huge percentage that mirrors that in carceral facilities of other kinds, right? Because there is this problem that we have in the United States with institutionalizing people and making it as cheap as fucking possible, because bodies, as we house them, are incredible centers of profit, clearly, right? But you can only do that if you run it absolutely bare bones. And this has been like devastating. And this is why so many people are dying. And then you throw in the way that legislators have been covering for the long-term care industry. And it's
yeah, I mean, add fold in the fact that the people you would expect, you can't really do this. Like that's the thing that really annoyed me, has always annoyed me about this as an issue, which is that like, you can't hive this off as one issue.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. They're like long-term care experts or whatever, but like when you hive it off as an issue, you basically restrict the potential pool of people who could mobilize for it to some of the, you know, people who are systematically denied the ability to mobilize. And then unpaid care workers who, at least ethnographic studies have shown, they don't see it as anything that they can mobilize around. They just feel it is their duty, and whatever suffering they have to endure for it, or like loss of job, loss of opportunities, whatever, like they just see that as like their, you know, the sort of part of a moral calculus.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point, Phil. Cause as I mentioned in like the kind of absurdity and like spinning long-term care off, like it's like vision and dental or whatever, like this is something that people are going to need. I mean,
like vision, I feel like
people
dental.
Have internalized. Well, yeah, but I think this is something like people have internalized. I think a lot of like our generation, I think, has internalized the idea that like retirement is a myth in this political economy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like we're not like, I don't know. I don't expect to ever be able to.
I don't
like,
even know what like, retirement is.
Well, for you, you're, I guess, already retired. Congratulations. I don't know. But
wait, we didn't throw me a retirement party. God damn.
But the
rude.
Yeah. But I mean, so we've normalized that to an extent. But I think that like one thing probably that doesn't necessarily get associated with that is it's like not just like, oh, you're probably never going to be able to retire or whatever, but like to the extent that you will, it's likely that, you know, eventually you will end up needing some form of long-term care, and essentially probably like literally statistically speaking, based on even numbers in this report, but also I don't know, like Google anything, like statistically will be
Google it
statistically will like need some form of long-term care, probably will not be able to pay for it because again, completely morally and literally bankrupt industry. And like without the, like with a total lack of, you know, any sort of like social welfare support for this type of care and for like that stage and for like both that stage of your life when you're elderly, but also for just like for the disabled in general, outside of like the incredibly punitive Medicaid system, basically, right? There's, you know, there's a good chance that not only will you not be able to retire, but then like you'll just end up being in like massive fucking debt from long-term care companies, right?
Right. Or you'll just die.
Or you'll just die.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, it's, you know, this is why it was so frustrating. Maybe this is a good way for us to transition into Kamala. But like, you know, Addie Barkin, the activist and patient with ALS, did a bunch of interviews with all of the Democratic candidates way back before COVID. He sat down with all of them. Everybody virtue signaled at him. Famously, Addie's monthly long-term care bill. Again, he has ALS, so it's like, and it's quite further down the line, so he needs 24-hour care, $9,000 a month. He's in a very privileged position of having been an attorney and had insurance. His wife has insurance, but also like He is the figurehead of a like huge nonprofit, so it's not difficult to fundraise for him, but there are thousands of other ALS patients who do not have the care that Addie has, who cannot live the last months of their life with their families in their own homes the way that Addie is, right? And and he sat down and talked to you, these other candidates, like all the candidates, and I remember Kamala Harris crying when she was talking to him.
Oh, yeah.
And being like, oh, I told myself I wasn't going to do this. And she was like crying. And this was in the context of her either just having or was just about to release her Medicare for All interpretation, shall we say.
Interpretive dance.
Yeah. Which was essentially a plan that said, let's do a 10-year transition. Let's move at the speed of evolution to private Medicare for all. I think we joke Medicare Advantage for all.
Yeah.
And
that's what it amounts to.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, the conversation was like this privileged person who has their long-term care, who has the like dignity and respect that like we are advocating for on every fucking episode of the show for every person, right? Mm-hmm. She's crying and saying she feels so bad. And yet at the same time, actively translating the issue that he is supposedly organizing behind into something completely different. And it was one of the most disheartening moments of the whole primary for me, frankly, like just personally. And it's,
well, you're used to seeing that kind of virtue signaling
from
people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess it didn't occur to me then, because the main spokesperson, as I recall, for Kamala's Medicare for All plan, let's not call it that, Kamala's plan, the plan, her plan.
Well, as the Medium post says, my plan for Medicare for All.
My plan.
Right.
You know, the main spokesperson back then was Neera Tanden. And this was really, her plan was not really her plan, but it was the Center for American Progress plan, which was, you know, a transition to Medicare Advantage for All. Nothing about long-term care. Not a thing. And effectively the fuller expansion of a new sort of corporatist arrangement within what is putatively looks like on the face of it, social insurance. And so when I thought about it, I was like, oh God, you know, here we are. This is now the Neera Tanden show on this. And I heard like a bunch of interviews with her sort of defending it. It never occurred to me that there could also be, I mean, I suppose I just thought like, wow, okay, this is now what like liberal policy like looks like. But it never occurred to me that one of the other people that supported this idea in its broad outlines was Stuart Butler, author of in his own words, the Leninist strategy to destroy Social Security back in the 80s.
What?
And it's like, now he has this article out basically saying like, hey, maybe, I think the article is called Medicare Advantage for All, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, and it really tells you, I mean, I think this is the, you know, as we kind of, I think, said from the top, like, you cannot, like, move one inch without like getting hit in the face with a fucking Kamala Harris take right now. And that's fine. But I think it's really, I do think it's really important overall. And that's why actually, like, I wrote a whole piece on this actually, for the Substack that I'm doing, Health and Capital. But I do think like one thing that is like extremely important is to like highlight what happened, here during the, during the, 2020, Democratic primary, because like you know, we talked about it probably what it was like more than a year ago or something, because more than a year ago, because Kamala released her plan in July of like the end of July of 2019, her, you know, quote-unquote Medicare for All plan, which again I guess for, you know, hereafter referred to as Medicare Advantage for All, I suppose. But you know, so like we talked about it over a year ago, and then for the most part, like politically, frankly, like in terms of like public conversation and politically, like Kamala Harris until what, like yesterday, until just like the other day at the VP announcement Tuesday, I think, you know, was basically like politically like meaningless. I mean, she did, you know, but it's worth like circling back on what she fundamentally like did here, which I think personally is like she really she did a lot of heavy lifting, frankly, in terms of the national stage or like the national conversation, at mm-hmm. least to sort of like normalize the co-optation and like reinterpretation of Medicare for All as something that could include mm-hmm. Private insurance plans at all.
And she was the first to do it. Yeah.
Well, she others. I mean, it was a big thing in the campaign to sort of like. I mean, they even had that like raise your hand moment or whatever that right. was like who would eliminate right. all private insurance from like their healthcare plan, and you know she was one of very few people who raised her hand, even though then later, like within 24 hours, this was in June 2019, like within 24 hours she would not even within 24 hours, very quickly after she like clarified in a statement, no, I misheard the question.
Yeah,
like,
she said she misunderstood it. Right. Yeah.
But like it wasn't so much that like she singularly was there in saying like, oh, I'll do some form of like expanding Medicare or doing a Medicare for All, but like let's keep a rule for private insurance. You know, even Warren kept the door open on that for a long time and mm-hmm. till the end, frankly. But but like in terms of like again actively doing the messaging, releasing a plan that is Medicare Advantage for All and calling it Medicare for All, for example, mm-hmm. like there is not in my opinion like someone who did, other than I guess again other than Warren, there's like not another person who did mm-hmm. more to like work against the like the fundamental messaging and purpose of like the single payer fight during the Democratic primary.
Right.
It's telling and it's mm-hmm. important to say like yes, this is in fact like the plan that she released as Medicare for All
right.
is in fact the idea of taking the shitty version of privatized Medicare, which is known as Medicare Advantage, expanding it again over the course of eventually over 10 years or whatever, expanding mm-hmm. it so that other mm-hmm. so that like everyone can theoretically have access to it, is the same plan basically as this, yeah, as Phil is saying, as this thing advanced by this like conservative fucking like Brookings Institution,
formerly Heritage guy. Foundation,
right? Yeah, like this is of course because like expanding Medicare Advantage would just be a fucking gold rush for private companies.
Right. Well, right. Vince, as
for insurance companies,
as you and I discussed with Dr. Victoria Dooley in our Medicare for All Week interview with her, like mm-hmm. Medicare Advantage plans are just straight up trash, right?
Yeah.
They often like drop people just for no reason. You really can only use it if you're healthy the moment you actually need it.
It's not there. And then also just the fundamentally the idea of a Medicare Advantage plan at all is just substandard, because the only thing that it does is introduces a private corporation, you know, like corporate middleman sucking money out of an exchange that or out of a like system that fundamentally just doesn't need another person like siphoning off money. But can I also say that I think the other thing that Artie, like reading your Substack, I think was like really good and was a really good refresher on like exactly what happened in the primary, because it to me signals not that Kamala Harris necessarily has strong feelings about this particular like Medicare Advantage for All type of system being the one that she wanted, but rather that like she doesn't give two shits about healthcare. She doesn't give two shits about like long-term care or anything like that. And this position that she took came out of, you know, essentially being squeezed from both sides and having to find this ridiculous middle ground. And then, you know, essentially reaching for the plan that like her corporate consultant put in front of her first.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think it should tell people that like Kamala Harris doesn't give a shit about this. She doesn't like have, you know, all that much like experience in it, and it is not her priority.
Well, the thing, the argument that I've heard from, you know, sort of defenders of Harris, or even just like people who are, I think, maybe trying to be more sober kind of political analysts about this, is like, what does her VP pick mean? And like, ultimately, it's a VP pick, not policy wise, not that much. Mm-hmm. But they're like, well, you know, at the very least, you know, there are meaningful differences between what she, you know, was for and what Joe Biden was for. Like, you know, the Biden healthcare thing is just like a pale imitation of anything,
right?
Like at all. But what my point is this: if we learned anything from the 2008 financial crisis, is that crises coupled with a brief period of unified democratic government, which is one equilibrium path that could happen after the election,
right?
They don't necessarily. So people are like, oh, well, you know, all of this very sort of, you know, possibility for change in like this period of unified democratic government. But one thing we know is that the way that it worked during the Great Recession is that you got a lot of policy done, but the wheels of it were greased. Like, and it had like sort of social democratic imprimatur. Like, there were literally academic books around that time called like another New Deal, or like, you know, like Obama's New Deal. And it's like, no, not at all, because the wheels of anything there were greased by, you know, effectively plutocratic interests. And so that, and like the reason to pay attention to Kamala's plan is not that like, yeah, this signals that now by that's the plan that Biden would accept.
No, no,
but it's that that could represent an edge of policy development that might emerge from this administration anyway, or a potential Biden administration anyway, because the crisis will be so bad. And that will be sort of like what, you know, the most organized and well-resourced interest might in some potential reality agree to if the crisis gets so much worse. It's funny, in reading all of this stuff from the Harris thing to the Stuart Butler thing, which was published like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's like, thinking about like just reading them in the context of a pandemic, it's like, what are you even talking about?
Right.
10 years? Like, you know, it's like that line from Alien. It's like, we're not going to last 10 minutes.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. But, and I think that's really, I think, the thing that I'm concerned about. Cause obviously, you know, as you've mentioned, Phil, like, it's a VP pick. Like, this is like a total, like,
this is nothing.
So whatever position, obviously I get that there's the argument that it's like somehow potentially more significant, whether it's because like perhaps Joe Biden is going to be a president not unlike, let's say, Ronald Reagan, in terms of the like daily administration of like the act of the presidency, or because, you know, just this makes her, you know, there's that whole like within a heartbeat of the presidency thing, whatever. Like,
right.
I get that argument, but until she's actually in like a legitimate seat of power, or they make some sort of announcement that it's like, well, Harris is going to like lead the healthcare policy or something, which I doubt they would do, because clearly it seems like they're using it politically, like. Her support of Medicare for all, in like her theoretical support of Medicare for all, or whatever, is already basically essentially being wielded as a weapon of convenience politically, right? It's like, you know, for people who think of themselves as progressives or whatever, they're like, oh, this is great. She supported Medicare for all. Maybe she will again. For people who are not, it's like, oh, well, this is either, you know, like a bad mark for her, or it's like, you know, at least she's moderated now or something, right? is the idea. But I think clearly, I don't think immediately, like I imagine that to the extent that the Biden administration, if the, again, theoretical Biden administration, if they even win, but like, I doubt that a hypothetical Biden administration would, you know, to the extent that they would even actually pursue any sort of meaningful healthcare legislation, I'm sure it'll look a lot more like the policy document or that they have on their website, or, you know, not even go that far potentially. But like in the longer term, I see this like potentially as a signal that, okay, you're elevating someone who like clearly demonstrated a willingness to and followed through with literally co-opting a movement, a material demand from a lot of people, for single payer in the United States, for a federal universal single payer. You co-opted the term Medicare for All to make it something that it was like fundamentally not, and into a policy that again is favored by conservative think tank guys, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to me, I guess my concern is, yeah, that this be that it becomes like slowly over time, you set the stage to like politically morph the idea of Medicare for All into being just another thing, like, you know, like how people like, if you've been following this fight for a long time, there's a reason that people for the most part don't say universal healthcare anymore, because universal healthcare was itself like, you know, reformed into like, oh, let's just do basically like ACA, right?
Right, mm-hmm.
Like,
exactly.
We're going to do universal healthcare. And what that means is universal coverage. Well, now it's like, well, okay, we're going to do Medicare for All. What that means is we're going to take the shittiest privatized version of Medicare. The one that, like, we're going to take the companies that literally get hit all the time for fraud, for upcharting patients to make it so that the government will pay out more, even if the person isn't as like sick as the, which also there are tiers to how it reimburse, whatever, like, like the absurdity of that itself is something else. But we're like, we're going to take these like predatory companies who literally are committing like fraud to like increase their profits off of each like Medicare patient, in not in every case, but in a lot of cases, like it's a preponderance throughout the industry. Like, we're going to take these companies and then, like that, and that'll be our, we'll give universal coverage through that. Like,
right.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, I mean, like, pre-existing conditions themselves, like, basically, like, how that term came into popular use was, like, interrogating the fact that, like, maternal care was considered a pre-existing condition,
right?
Mm-hmm. And interrogating the fact that treatment for cancer, right, could disqualify you from, like, treating a remissed cancer. And it has, like, been completely changed in the public eye to, instead of something that like represents a critique of like the health finance system, into like a protected class, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the translation of that in and of itself, and the way that like the pre-existing condition as an idea has like come to be wielded, frankly, against those with pre-existing conditions clinically, like particularly people with diabetes, has been absolutely violent. And one of the things that I think we talked about, like when it sort of got down to like a Bernie, Biden, Liz Warren fight in the media, that they were talking about it as a sort of like trifecta, is like, I had very real concern that like what we were watching Warren doing was going to like absolutely undermine the meaning of Medicare for All, right? Mm-hmm. Which would mean that like we would lose the literacy behind it, right? And all of the work that's been done for the past like 40 years, right, to try and bring the idea of a federal universal single payer up within a, you know, neoliberal policy framework as best we can. And what happens when these things are translated is they like absolutely lose their power, you know?
Right. I mean, because they do have the effect of this sort of domestication of the idea, the taming and subduing of the idea has the effect of removing some of the worst sort of exigencies of the system. And like, I mean, we saw with Medicare Part D. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
All of the concern, you can track it in public opinion surveys. It's public concern with the cost of pharmaceuticals is rising. Medicare Part D passes. Public opinion and like it, just attention to the issue and just concern about the issue plummets, just drops entirely, and prices keep rising.
Well, and yeah. And also, it to me, what like is so funny about, or funny, I don't know, is depressing about this, right, is that like at the end of the day, her system is effectively just like a protection racket for companies that pay, like sort of like paid lobbying money on one side and then like, you know, have it like returned another way. I mean, it's like, it's literally just like an investment scheme, right, for companies that like need not exist.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it does sort of suggest that like the, if this is like one reason why you would, or one potential effect of like choosing a vice president, especially, you know, if you win and they become much more prominent figure in the party, you know, a sort of like de facto leader of the party, it has an effect on the way that the party is built, which kinds of candidates move up and the way that sort of interests surrounding the party are aligned.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, if this is what that sort of represents, then, you know, I'm not the strategy of, you know, sort of reforming or like radically changing the party from within, you know, I think is a, maybe a bigger gamble, right? And that like maybe the, you know, for all of its potential benefits, electoralism really has, you know, real, especially in the short term, limits on what it can accomplish, right? Building a bench is one thing, but you know, you have people in office and this is ultimately even that's the furthest reaches. I mean, that's like, if you're really lucky, they do what is in the Medium post, right? If like right. you're really lucky, if that's what historians have to go back and write about.
Right.
Totally. Right.
So, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, but I guess I'm really frustrated about talking about this because it's like, why I've been off of this particular branch of Twitter for a moment and it's like, why is this? It's such an, you know, everyone knows that the VP stakes is like the least interesting, you know, like form of politics or like form of political discourse. But like, why it's attracting so much attention and it's just like sucking the energy out of a lot of other far more important things. If you think about where we began the week, like on Monday.
Right.
So why is this such an alluring thing for people to continue wasting their energy on?
Well, I mean, I think I have a very clear answer for you, which is the moment that the VP like news cycle started up, I had the sensation that I think people were just like stoked to pretend for like 24 to 48 hours that like anything was normal.
That's true.
Basically, right.
Denial, you know, it's is like quite powerful.
It's you just like give, you know, you hand out the like you produce the like a very regular PR cycle in the same way that like a campaign sort of normally would or whatever, right? And it like sort of gives people something to focus on. I'm sure also for like plenty of liberals or whatever who were like not particularly like excited about Joe Biden, even if they're like, you know, excited to like vote Trump out of office or whatever, who are like, yeah, Biden's good or something, that like, I'm sure it like stoked, it appears to have stoked something in like a bunch of them. Not that I particularly like care about their sentiments, right. I guess,
yeah.
Especially because, yeah, again, as Phil, you're mentioning plague,
right.
mass evictions, like people like unemployment has stopped, so now like people are literally like the stuff that's being like posted on like r/unemployment now has gone from like, please don't let the benefits expire, like this is amazing, like for the first time in my life I feel like I have a ounce of stability,
right,
to basically like,
what are they doing?
Well, to basically like, okay, so wow, this stuff gets really bad really quick, like we can't afford like medicine anymore, much less our rent,
yeah,
you know, right. Like this is, I mean, so while everyone's, yeah, whatever, while everyone's like clapping for the VP pick or whatever, like, yeah, everything's still fucking terrible.
Yeah, I think a lot of this has sort of like also been, it's been unfortunate to revisit the attitudes of sort of like condescension towards people that are like terrified and frustrated that anyone could be satisfied with like the current like state of the election and, you know, like the people that are like, you know, how dare you ever say that you're not going to vote for Joe Biden and Kamala or that they're like just as bad as Trump. Like, don't you understand? It's like, well, so clearly are you coming from a position that is so different probably from the person you are talking down to, because if you were probably in the position you're talking down to, you wouldn't be super like worried about spending all your time online defending Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. You'd probably be on our unemployment freaking out.
Probably
about,
wouldn't think there's a lot of agency in your one vote.
Yeah. And right. Maybe you're like a little bit more like worried about maybe dying, getting evicted, any of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like your material survival, to really feel like willing or happy or comfortable engaging with that dialogue, regardless of what you're going to do in November with your ballot at the end of the day, right?
Like,
I mean, regardless of what anyone wants to talk about, that the calculus of voting or the differences between the parties or candidates, like that, to me, I want to leave that to sort of one side and not deal with it actually.
Yeah.
In my analysis, which is, I also think it's like the expression of dissatisfaction with choices is a fundamentally democratic act.
Right.
And it ought to, you know, inform us about something. It's an odd form of censorship and a very sort of authoritarian mindset to say, you may not, how dare you express your dissatisfaction with things. And it does have a way of reinforcing this notion of who the electorate is, which we know is like, there's been a class bias in the electorate for years.
Right.
And one wonders why this is, right? Why on earth is this? Because there are not, you know, politicians that are running for this high a level of office and are successful in, you know, making it to the general, who are willing to actually make these sorts of make appeals on the basis of the sort of fundamental misguidedness of the system. I mean, effectively what we are going to see, and you heard it actually yesterday in the announcement and the speeches, which were probably the best speeches that either of them has given. But what it lands on,
not saying a lot,
the best speeches that they've given, like land on, is a restoration campaign.
Right. Yeah.
And saying like the problem here, the fundamental problem, the only problem is Trump. And you know, maybe in a narrow electoral sense, that's what you have to do. But it, to me, it doesn't, you know, it has a lot of assumptions baked in about what people are experiencing and why.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Phil, because like you're saying, considering that like voting had a, like turnout disparities along class lines, that's not just like, you know, that's not just accounted for in what, like, you know, you hear about from your pod saves or whatever, which is like the legitimate acts of like voter suppression and disenfranchisement that like happen in like more direct, I guess, that happen in like more direct structural ways. It's like, but it's also just like the, like there is not like the class interests of most people are not actually reflected in like anything in mainstream politics from either party. I mean, the case in point, like, you know, what's the old Schumer quote, for every blue collar Democrat we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we pick up two moderate Republicans in suburbs in Philadelphia, and you repeat that in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin. I mean, if that's what you literally just straight out say is part of the like goal of your politics, then like, what are people supposed to hear except for like, yep, they don't, no one in power cares about me.
Right.
Right.
And you prove that on a material level when suddenly people are being forced out of their homes or are not able to buy food or medicine abruptly because of, and very clearly from policy decisions that are being covered in the news that are clearly demonstrated. Like that's such a direct, I mean, it's such a direct feedback. It's like,
no, but oh, it's okay. The unemployment numbers dipped below 1 million for the first time in weeks. So everything's fixed, right? That line
to
go down.
Like what, 970,000 or something.
Yeah. Like, right. But just on a technical standpoint, it qualifies. So, you know, this isn't a Pan Am stewardess weigh-in.
Oh, or is it?
No, it's clearly not. Well, I think probably this is a good place to wrap it for today. As always, if you'd like an extra episode every week, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
Mm-hmm.
Also join our Discord and come hang for the reading group on Sundays at 5 p.m. Eastern. Anyone can join. You don't have to be a patron.
Or just come hang out in the Discord.
Or just come hang out. Yeah.
Always a good place.
Always a good place. I think with that, we'll call it an episode.
Yep.
Medicare for all now. Solidarity forever. Stay alive another week.
All right.
Ooh. Take care, y'all. Yeah.